This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's been a decade since a slogan, a hashtag, made its way around the world. And unlike most hashtags, this one stuck. Three words, Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter doesn't sound like a radical proposition. In fact, it should be self-evident. But those words became a rallying cry. Then an organization, and then a movement that rivaled the civil rights era of 50 years earlier. The phrase Black Lives Matter first appeared in a Facebook post after an unarmed teenager, Trayvon Martin, was shot and his killer walked free.
After George Zimmerman was acquitted, I think there was a real sense, I mean, I can speak for myself and other Black folks that I know, not just that justice had not been served, but that that verdict essentially said to Black people across this country that our lives don't matter, that we can be holding a Skittles and an iced tea and still be killed, that we can be sitting in our cars and gas stations listening to loud music and be killed, that we can be knocking on someone's door and asking for help and be shot.
Alicia Garza was one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, and we spoke in 2016. And at its height, in the worldwide protests that followed George Floyd's murder, Black Lives Matter also became a lightning rod for all kinds of backlash, including a newly energized white supremacy movement. And this week, we're looking at Black Lives Matter in its 10th year. So let's start at the beginning.
Breaking overnight, the verdict is in.
We, the jury, find George Zimmerman not guilty.
Protests break out after the high-stakes trial that gripped the country.
Sabrina, it has been 11 years since your youngest son, Trayvon Martin, was killed in Sanford, Florida. When people don't know what happened in 2012, how do you go about telling them?
Oftentimes, I do, start from the beginning and tell people who I am and how I became a speaker and how I became an activist and a writer and all of those things.
Sabrina Fulton is Trayvon Martin's mother.
A lot of people know, you know, my youngest son, but I have two boys. I have one in heaven and I have one on earth. So, you know, a lot of people think that there are triggers, but I guess it just feels natural to me to talk about my son just like any other parent. And so I tell them about Trayvon Martin was 17 years old. He was unarmed. And you had a vigilante that was 28 years old that followed him, chased him, profiled him, and ultimately shot and killed him. Trayvon was unarmed and he was 17. And he thought as a 17-year-old.
What do you mean he thought as a 17-year-old?
He was actually on a telephone call with a young lady, one of his friends that was here in Miami. And he was not paying attention, you know, he's right. Just like another kid, not paying attention and not being aware of his surroundings. Something parents tell you all the time, you know, pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. But he had candy and he had a drink and he was coming from the store, headed back to where him and his dad were staying at the time. And somebody took it upon themselves as a neighborhood watch captain, a wannabe police officer, but he decides that he wants to follow Trayvon to find out where he's going or who he is, you know? And I just want to say this, that we have to be careful for all our kids because Trayvon Martin could have been anybody's son at 17.
Tell me a little bit about Trayvon himself. Tell me about his name. Tell me what he was like. Where did he get his name from?
He got his name from his dad because his dad's name was Tracy, but he didn't want to name him Tracy. So He came up with Trayvon and I agreed.
And tell me what he was like as a kid.
He was very affectionate. He was definitely a mama's boy. He liked to eat chips and popcorn and candy. And he just was a big kid. He loved airplanes. But what he didn't know if he wanted to fix the plane or did he want to fly the plane?
How long did it take for you to recover from the initial shock of his death? And in that same year, you and your family founded the Trayvon Martin Foundation.
I think I'm going to be recovering from his death the rest of my life because it's so unnatural to bury a child. It's the worst pain ever because I've lost family members, but this is the first child that I've lost. And it's something that's severe that if you have not experienced this, you wouldn't understand. You wouldn't understand losing a person that you carry for 9 months. And now that person is walking, your heart is walking outside your body, literally. And now your heart has been killed. And now you have to continue to function. You have to continue to move forward. You have to continue to be trusting God. You have to continue to be positive and try to live your life. And it's hard. It's a struggle. It's a struggle every day. I'm still Trayvon Martin's mom. I'm still Javaris Fulton's mom. It doesn't matter how old they are. I'm always going to be mom.
At what point did it become obvious to you that Trayvon's name would become this, it just took on a hugely important and resonant presence in the world. And a year later, Black Lives Matter was first posted on social media.
I think when we went to New York, we was at Union Square, they had something called the Million Hoodie March. And we had just finished doing like a whole set of interviews with different people about what had happened. We was trying to get an arrest. And Reverend Sharpton was the last person we interviewed with. And he said, you know, they're doing a Million Hoodie rally. And since you guys are in town in New York, you should stop over and just say a few words and thank the people. So we thought maybe, okay, a few people would be out there and we was just gonna go out there. I was already sick. I'm not used to New York weather. I'm used to Florida weather, of course. And we went out there and when we got out the vehicles, it was like packed with people. Like it was thousands of people. And we were like, what's going on? And they were like, this is the Million Hoodie Rally. And what I found out later is that an organization got this together in like about 2 to 3 days because there was so many people out there. I'm not going to say they didn't know who he was. They definitely knew who he was, but they had never met him. It resonated with a lot of people. A lot of people felt. They didn't quite feel what we were feeling, but it hurt. One thing I think about now as we are talking about this, my son, who was 17 years old, who was unarmed, was on the ground, deceased. The person that was standing over him with the loaded gun was able to go home into it and get in his bed. He went to the police station and then he went home. My son went to the morgue. They did a drug and alcohol testing on my son, but they never did drug and alcohol testing and a background check on the person who stood over him with the loaded gun. It seems twisted. It looks like you would do drug and alcohol testing on the person who shot the gun, not the person who received the bullet. So that right there shows you that United States has a problem with color, number one, because had my son shot someone, they definitely would have did a background check on him. They definitely would have did a drug and alcohol testing on him, and he would have been behind bars that night.
He was so resonant that I think I remember President Obama saying, if I'd had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin.
Yes.
But my main message is to the parents of Trayvon Martin. You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. And, you know, I think they are right to expect that all of us, as Americans, are going to take this with the seriousness it deserves, and that we're going to get to the bottom of exactly what happened.
The next year, in 2013, you testified in front of a Senate subcommittee to demand changes to what's called the Stand Your Ground laws. What did you know about the law before Trayvon was killed? What did Trayvon know, if anything? And what do you know now?
I had no clue what Stand Your Ground was. It was through our attorneys that told us. I think most people had not heard about Stand Your Ground. They knew about the Castle Doctrine, meaning you can protect yourself in your own household. But nobody really heard about the Stand Your Ground law.
Sabrina, at around the same time that Black Lives Matter started, you founded something called Circle of Mothers, which is a nonprofit organization that hosts retreats for grieving mothers.
Yes. I got up in the middle of the night and I got a paper and I got a pen and I just started writing because it was as if I had already been to the Circle of Mothers. I can't even explain it. I got on the phone and I started sending text messages out and I told them, listen, you all have to meet with me so I can tell you this idea that I had. People were telling me about their dogs, their grandmother, their great-grandmother, a mother, father. It's nothing like losing a child. You know, they think it's even. They think and I don't want to take away from someone's loved one, but by the same token, it's not the same thing. The only person that reached out to me that I felt really understood what I was going through was Tupac Shakur's mother, Afeni Shakur. She was my first keynote speaker. And I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it. I'm going to take it to my grave because I felt like nobody understood.
8 years after your son died came the summer of 2020 and George Floyd and an uprising in many cities around this country, many cities and towns, and people thought things would get markedly better. Have they?
To a certain extent, yes. I have seen police officers now being arrested and actually being convicted and going to jail. Even with George Floyd, we didn't have a lot of faith that that officer was going to be held accountable for his actions. You know, and we can't have that. I mean, right before our eyes. So I was, you know, not happy, but I felt like it's about time they did something about it. He had a trial, he had a jury, and he was convicted, and he's in jail. Okay, that one was held accountable. But there's so many others that were not held accountable.
Sabrina Fulton is the mother of Trayvon Martin, and her group Circle of Mothers hosts an annual retreat for mothers who've lost children to gun violence. We'll continue in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and we're talking today about Black Lives Matter, which was first used as a hashtag in 2013, 10 years ago. Now, I've never had the experience of being followed by security in a store. I've never been stopped and frisked, wrongly accused, or manhandled by the police. But millions of people, principally Black Americans, report that this kind of treatment happens to them all the time. Where earlier civil rights struggles centered on voting rights or discrimination in schooling, Black Lives Matter focused above all on policing, on excessive stops, on use of force and violence, all directed at Black and brown people. And Black Lives Matter popularized the slogan, "Defund the police," which quickly became a matter of controversy. To try to gauge the impact of Black Lives Matter over the past decade, we're joined by Kai Wright, who's the host of WNYC's Notes from America.
10 years into the movement that emerged following Trayvon Martin's horrific killing, there's a simple question you could ask. Has there been any measurable change in addressing police violence and abuse? The answer is not simple. There have been many, many efforts at fixing this problem, but we're going to dig into three specific areas of reform: transparency, accountability, and just tracking the problem. We gathered three experts who come at these challenges from slightly different angles. Anya Bidwell is an attorney for the Institute for Justice. Mike White is a professor of criminology at Arizona State University. And Samuel Sinyangwe is the founder of Mapping Police Violence and Police Scorecard. Samuel was in his 20s, working at a nonprofit that focused on economic and social equality when Trayvon Martin was killed. And he was used to having access to all kinds of data in his work. So after Mike Brown was killed a little later, Samuel decided, I want to create a national database that tracks the number of police fatalities. But when he got started, he found very little to work with. I asked him, why was the data so bad?
So the data was so bad because the federal government was relying on a program where you had 18,000 different law enforcement agencies across the country. It was a voluntary program whereby the federal government was asking each of those 18,000 agencies to report what homicides took place, and whether those were what they call justifiable homicides, which is their word for homicide committed by the state or a homicide committed by an individual understand your ground laws or other cases was deemed justifiable. You know, an article from 538 came out in the early weeks following the death of Mike Brown that basically tore apart that methodology. There were websites like killbypolice.net at the time. There was an individual, a volunteer individual who wasn't being paid for this, who would just search for keywords like killing by police, police-involved killing, officer-involved shooting. And what that 538 article did was they looked at that list at killbypolice.net, and they found that there were nearly three times as many cases on that list as what the federal government was reporting.
Hundreds of homicides by law enforcement agencies between 2007 and 2012 aren't included in records kept by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It's the findings of
But the issue was that the work hadn't been done to really analyze that data. Many of the cases hadn't been coded by race. There was no information about the circumstances of those cases, whether the folks were armed or unarmed, what police department was responsible, what patterns were in the data that could help point to potential solutions. So a lot of the work to just basically understand and address the most fundamental questions that an emerging mass movement was demanding. The fundamental question of how many people have been killed by police, whether things are getting better or worse, and what we can learn from the data in terms of solutions to ultimately reduce police violence.
And Samuel, in as much of a nutshell, I know I don't want you're a data scientist. I don't want to make you be reductive about your data, but work with me. In a nutshell, what have you found?
So over the past 10 years, and from 2013 through the present, what we can say is that police kill about 1,200 people every single year. And that didn't start when the national conversation became focused on police violence. It's something that has happened at a remarkably regular and constant pace, about 1,050 and 1,250 people.
And it's a remarkable number.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about more than three people every single day. What we also know when we unpack the data is how deeply systemic this issue is. We have a system of 18,000 different law enforcement agencies, each with their own set of policies and practices, their own department culture. Some have more or less funding, more or fewer employees. That constellation of 18,000 agencies every single year kills a similar number of people. The patterns are remarkably similar year after year as well. Black people are about three times more likely to be killed than white people per population. Latinos killed between 1.5 and 2 times at higher rate than white people per population. Native Americans also killed a similar rate as black people. So again, much higher than white people.
Despite this centralized system, there is a repetitive outcome, even though it's so dispersed across the system. I want to get Anya and Professor White into this part of the conversation too. And Anya, you were nodding fiercely as Samuel described the state of the data, how bad the data was and has been. What is the lived consequences of that? What does that mean for like the work you do, not having information like that?
You know, Justice Brandeis once famously said that sunlight is the best of disinfectants. And transparency really is extremely important in those types of situations. And I don't think it's surprising that in many controversial topics, we don't have good data, right? For example, Second Amendment and the use of guns, that's another area where it's very hard to actually find the data. For us as lawyers, it is much easier to, file complaints, filed class action lawsuits, have allegations in the complaint that are backed by data. That's a much stronger lawsuit that can take you much farther, even though there still will be other doctrines that we'll talk about that will still make it difficult.
Professor Mike, why is that the case? Why don't we have a centralized system for collecting data from the federal government?
You know, there is an effort now to create a national level use of force database. The FBI is leading that effort. It started, I believe, in 2019. It is voluntary. One thing I think we do need to keep in mind is that each year there are more than 50 million encounters between police officers and community members across the United States. More than 50 million. The vast majority of those encounters begin and end peacefully, and not all of those police killings are excessive, inappropriate, unlawful uses of force. Some number of those police killings are justified.
And so with that context in mind, Samuel, there's been a decade of activism and greater public conversation about this at minimum. There's been a decade of someone like yourself saying, well, let's track this. Is there anything that we can point to in your data that says, okay, well, this is getting better, or no?
As Michael said, you know, this is something that policing is much broader than those 1,200 incidents. There are between 6 and 10 million arrests made every single year. And we do see some important shifts in terms of overall police contact and enforcement. Over the past decade, particularly there's been a substantial reduction in arrests, particularly arrests for lower level nonviolent offenses. And, you know, this is important because, you know, when we consider, you know, 6 to 10 million arrests, I mean, that's a lot of people. If you have an arrest record, that impacts your ability to get a job, it impacts your ability to get housing, it impacts a range of opportunities for you. It often results in incarceration, which has its own negative health effects. Reductions in arrests overall, particularly for low-level offenses, have across the country over the past decade, they were accelerated during the pandemic, but have really been concentrated in some of the largest cities in the country.
We should all agree the answer is not to defund the police. Right. It's to fund the police.
And so much of that money is focused on stops and arrests and police activity and enforcement really targeted towards low-level nonviolent issues that are often associated with crimes of poverty, issues of mental health and substance use, so drug possession, loitering or vagrancy, often trespassing, crimes associated with sex work, so prostitution arrests, et cetera, have seen substantial declines across the country. The cities that have made the largest reductions in arrests, particularly for low-level offenses, have also seen some reductions in police shootings, both fatal and non-fatal, because there are fewer incidents that are, often escalate. You know,
because there's fewer opportunities to engage in the first place.
Exactly.
So, but speaking of the number of arrests and the volume of engagement with police departments, one of the things that has come up in the years since the Black Lives Matter movement became part of the political conversation is body cameras, and that it was supposed to be something that was, at least in the popular conversation, going to be, you know, hey, this helps. This gives us eyes on the interaction of all those millions of interactions that are happening between cops and everyday people. And so Professor Mike, can we start with you because you have studied this issue? What actually were body cameras supposed to do? What was the argument behind body cameras?
You know, many departments simply did it as a show of transparency. I can't tell you how many press conferences I saw of chiefs of police announcing the start of a body-worn camera program and saying, we're doing this because we've got nothing to hide.
January 1st, 800 body cameras will be dispersed among
officers. Simply, I don't want to be the next Ferguson. And then there was some early evidence that suggested if you deployed cameras, you would see reductions in use of force and complaints. There were a handful of studies that came out in 2013, 14, 15 that showed that. I think those were the primary drivers of the adoption.
From all of those sort of different vantage points of people who were who said, okay, this is a good idea for me, what have we learned?
You know, it depends on which outcome you're focused on. The studies on use of force are much more mixed. Again, about 30 studies, and only half of those studies show a reduction in use of force after cameras are deployed. So for me, the big takeaway is that you're not going to see one story with body-worn cameras being deployed in a department. There's too many other contextual factors that come into play. The big one being, what's the state of a police department when they deploy cameras? And that was the case in Ferguson. You know, within 30 days of Michael Brown's death, Ferguson police officers started wearing cameras. But you could also have a department that deploys cameras as part of just one more professional activity that department does. So the starting point of a police department is extraordinarily important. Is it a department in trouble, and this is why they're deploying cameras, or is the department professional? And they're respectful in their contacts with community members. They hold their officers accountable. And this is just one more thing they're doing to maintain that level of professionalism. So I think
to spell out, what is the distinction there in terms of what happens then? If it matters, which makes sense to me, it matters how they come into it. How do the outcomes vary based on whether they come into it?
If a department is in trouble. So for example, the Rialto Police Department in California was the first to not only deploy cameras, but to rigorously study those cameras. And they showed immediate, significant reductions in use of force. But that department was in significant trouble. I mean, there was some discussion about whether that department was going to get shut down by the Rialto City Council. And you have a reform chief come in who does a bunch of things, including deploying the cameras. Compare that to the Washington, D.C. Metro Police Department. When they did their study, they didn't document any impact on use of force, but the DC Metro Police Department had been under consent decree for a decade before they deployed cameras. So the consent decree that was in place, the Federal Monitor, required significant organizational change and improvement over a period of 10 years. Not surprisingly, they don't see a big reduction in use of force because I think all of the things that happened over the prior decade, that department was in a much better place organizationally when they deployed cameras versus a department like Rialto.
But I'll tell you from experience that even when you do have video footage, and if that video footage shows an officer behaving unreasonably, very often courts are still going to give qualified immunity to the officer. I have an example of a case in Arkansas where a police officer held at gunpoint two children, a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old.
I've got two juvenile individuals, dark hoodies and pants.
And you could think if there is no footage, no video footage, you could imagine that a 14-year-old might have looked threatening and maybe older and had a mature voice, that it would have been reasonable for an officer to mistake him for an adult. But that video footage shows very clearly that these are children.
Get on the ground. Put your hands out.
Right, they're answering, they're complying with the police officer 100%. He's yelling at them, he is pointing a gun at them, he is forcing them on the ground. And still, even with that footage, the constitutional lawsuit was dismissed because of qualified immunity.
There are many different circumstances and structures under which this program is being implemented in various cities. In most cases across the country, body cameras are a tool that allows law enforcement to collect video that they then get to decide what to do with. And that alone, I think, is not sufficient to provide for the type of accountability that I think community members expect or demand. And we've seen this. I think about Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge. He was killed by Baton Rouge Police Department. And it took years to actually reveal that there was hidden footage that the police department kept under wraps. And finally, that footage came out years after. Family members were told that there was footage that exists but weren't allowed to see it. Community members were kept in the dark about this footage. Finally, the footage came out. It showed that prior to the cell phone footage that the country saw, the officers came up to him with the body camera footage, showing that they pointed their gun at him, pointed it at his head, threatened to kill him, escalating the situation in a way that, you know, the cell phone footage alone didn't show.
DC leaders are working to stop the crime crisis that's been plaguing our city for months.
So in DC, just this week, you know, they have been pushing legislation that would allow officers to review body camera footage before they write their statements about what happened in the incident.
Yeah, Samuel's comments are well taken, and you know, there are a couple of states that that have passed laws that impose restrictions on the police. And so the state of California, for example, passed a law requiring that every police department in the state of California release footage of critical incidents, officer-involved shootings, within 45 days. It's state law. You must. The Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, they release footage of officer-involved shootings within 72 hours of the incident. 72 hours, they'll have a press conference. They show the raw footage. And I think that's, you know, that's a tremendous show of transparency. But the other thing with, you know, the impact, I mean, think about the Tyre Nichols beating. You know, those officers were wearing body cameras and those cameras were activated. They were recording. How could that possibly happen? It happened because those officers had no concern that they were ever going to be asked about their behavior.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Kai Wright has joined us, and he's talking with three experts about the impact of the Black Lives Matter movement on policing in America.
Speaking of holding officers to account for their behavior, Anya, qualified immunity has come up a few times. This is a federal doctrine that is established via Supreme Court rulings at this point, and it gives government officials, including cops, a lot of protection from being sued for doing their job. That's the idea, right? So for police, it's in part to allow them to make these split-second decisions. And as long as they can prove that the decision they made was reasonable based on precedent, that means they're safe, right?
And in cases where you have camera footage, very often it still makes no difference because qualified immunity very much focuses on what would have an objectively reasonable officer done, not what would have this very particular officer done.
Well, let's talk about it on two levels. One, this is a thing that is a consequence of law. So first off, if it would have to change, this would have to be Congress would need to pass a law saying we get rid of qualified immunity.
Or the Supreme Court can overturn its 1982 decision and say qualified immunity doesn't apply. Or it is, like you said, Congress could do it tomorrow if it wanted.
In today's world, we are more likely looking at Congress would have to pass a law that says we want to get rid of qualified immunity. So then in absent a new law, either from Congress or from the Supreme Court, what does that then mean in court for you, and particularly if there's been a change in the past 10 years for how to get accountability despite the existence of qualified immunity?
One option that private lawyers, civil rights lawyers, any lawyers have also is to go to state courts and sue under state laws. That's why Colorado, for example, after the murder of George Floyd, passed its statute saying that you can sue police officers for excessive force and qualified immunity will not be an obstacle. New Mexico was another state that passed a similar statute. In New Mexico, though, they said you sue police officer, but it is the municipality as the employer of the police officer that will be held liable incentivizing municipalities and police departments to hire and train better.
Anya, when we talk about the way conservatives think about this topic, there are more than one sets of views here. Also, the Institutes of Justice was funded in part by one of the Koch brothers, Charles Koch. How do you see the different sort of layers of understanding of this and feeling about criminal justice reform amongst conservatives?
So let's start with Justice Thomas, for example, right? He and Justice Sotomayor agree that qualified immunity has serious issues. And a lot of conservative jurists are also suspicious of policymaking by the court, right? The original understanding of the role of the judiciary is that judges are the ones that are supposed to see whether the right was violated and then order a remedy. And then it is up to the legislative body to worry about incentives, and deterrence effects and then impose some sort of an immunity. Congress has never blessed qualified immunity in any shape or form. So conservatives and liberals are suspicious of qualified immunity, perhaps for different reasons, but they end up often agreeing with each other. We understand that maybe qualified immunity shouldn't be as big of a burden when you sue a mayor, but when it comes to police officer, maybe it should be a big burden because police officers often act in the heat of the moment. So there is also that other part of conservative bench that's worried about those kind of repercussions.
Which, that points us to some really fundamental questions that kind of swirl in this debate. There is a difference between reducing crime at any cost and keeping the public safe, but also in keeping police officers safe. And it sort of depends on what politically you have centered. And I guess the bottom line is, can we do all three? Can all three of these things happen? Can you reduce crime, keep the public safe, and keep police officers safe?
Yes. Yes, as long as we have the system of checks and balances that operates properly, right? So, for example, in my field, when it comes to people being able to sue and as a result keep government officials accountable, it's great when courts are the ones that are looking at whether the law was violated and then ordering a remedy for the individual. But then it is absolutely up to the political legislative branches to look at whether there need to be some protections implemented through laws that would protect police officers, for example. If everybody does what they're supposed to do, then we can actually have a win-win-win situation.
I think Anya's right. I think the structures are there to deliver on all three of those. The principles of a police accountability are well known, that starts with, good recruitment and selection of officers, train them properly, supervise them, hold them accountable when they make mistakes. We've known that for decades. If you're the chief of police, you have to deliver on that.
We will have to leave it with that. All three of you, thank you for your work and thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
That's Kai Wright, the host of Notes from America, which airs on public radio stations on Sunday evenings. And we heard from Samuel Sinyangwe, the creator of Mapping Police Violence, along with Anya Bidwell, an attorney for the Institute for Justice, and Mike White, a professor of criminology at Arizona State University. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've been talking in this program about the decade since Black Lives Matter was launched as a movement online.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri. But there are conflicting reports about what led up to the shooting. NBC's John Yang has the details.
One of the police killings that became a huge national story in the years before George Floyd's death happened in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson. An officer shot an unarmed teenager, Michael Brown, after a petty theft report, and the officer was never charged. Eventually, the Department of Justice investigated, producing a 100-page report. That report covered not only Brown's killing, but a culture of discrimination and corruption in the Ferguson Police Department. There was copious evidence of disproportionate arrests and ticketing of black residents, as well as viciously racist emails shared among officers.
And like everyone else, I was following the case. I was disturbed. I was so many things, angry.
Nicole Seeley is a poet, and she dealt with the Ferguson report in a way that was entirely unique.
While I did not come to the report to erase it, I was just very taken with everything, with the story, with Michael Brown, with the murder. I wanted to understand to some degree how these things could happen and could continually happen. I was just following my spirit.
Seeley spoke to The New Yorker's poetry editor, Kevin Young.
It's such a great pleasure to talk with you about the Ferguson Report and erasure. And I want to talk a little bit about the process of making the book. What is exactly an erasure?
Well, an erasure is a reconsideration of a text. And so I reimagined the Ferguson Report by erasing it. And I erased whole sections, whole blocks of text. And so what is left then is a wholly new creative document. I was reading it, the printed version, and when I found that I was striking through, I was like, oh, this is something that I'm doing. I don't know why I'm doing it. I don't know if it was to try to undo whatever harm, but I just instinctively began to erase and highlighting words that moved me making various phrases different colors. Maybe I would come back to them, but it was really difficult once I realized what I was doing to find kind of the lyrical leaps and lyrical narratives, the images. It was difficult to find those things in a document that is so formal and so filled with pure fact. And I think that's why it was so important for me to circle and highlight letters within words to create the lyric where the lyric was hiding.
Well, I love the way you're putting it, that it was hiding, because I think when I knew that you were doing this, and then when I saw the end result, the poems, the lifted poems, I don't think I imagined that you were doing this from word to word, that you were taking, mm-hmm. you know, two S's and ES from a word. And you don't rearrange them. They're all in order that you find them. But, mm-hmm. you know, you might find an H here. I'm looking at one of the first poems, an OR here, an S True. There. You have nay, which I think was neighborhood, and it becomes yep. neighing. Yep. You know, so you're finding, you know, these connections that are visual, but also, as you put it, lyrical and sonic. How much was the sound leading you through this process?
The sound was very much leading me through. As I said, I was trying to find lyric where there was none. And so often sound would be the driving force in trying to find the lyric. Repetition, you know, assonance, alliteration, these things would drive the poem because there was no story. There are stories, but not any that are inspiring. And there are no images, no surreal images. So yeah, I had to really create these things, and especially one movement. I'm forgetting now the page numbers, but the section with the repetition of force. Force, force, force. It wasn't until pages after all these forces that I had read that I realized that there was a repetition within the document of the word force. And so that repetition too was kind of the engine that drove that movement in the collection.
Well, I think I have it here. You say use of force, force of habit, of nature, force feed, force down, force his hand, force in line, full force.
Force in line, full force, by force, show of force, brute force, blunt force to be reckoned with. Force a smile, as law enforcement turns out, in force, to force, open your door.
It really highlights the force that, and maybe the forces that lie behind the report, which I think is so powerful because it isn't it's a damning report of a time and a place. Even in its initial form, it really lays out case after case, you know, and it's I wonder if you think people will go back to the report after they come to you.
I hope so. You know, that's one of the goals for this work. I think the erasure is just as important as what it has erased. And so I'm thinking now of the initial impulse to erase. I think I did so partly because I wanted more eyes on the report. I wanted more people to read it, to see what was going on in Ferguson. And I'm thinking that Ferguson is not the exception, but the rule, that this occurs in you know, any city USA.
Horses, hundreds, neighing. Part reflex, part reason, part particular urge. At gunpoint among them, you are. Less likely to live, into the wild go the captive born. Home in the high grass, a barking dog chokes itself against the pull of a tight leash, its neck extending farther than cries for help. A kind of headlight echoing, increasing in reach. The forecast red, the city red, diminishing to the proportion of whoever said death comes in threes is an optimist.
I didn't walk away from the completing of this project knowing more than I did going in. I have many more questions, wanting to know how for so many years, you know, these things are allowed to happen and allowed to happen to folks that look like me. There's just so much more I want to say and so much that is left unsaid. And so I think my editors were so... they got a bit angry with me towards the end because I kept changing things. But I kept changing things because, I mean, as you know, Kevin, there's infinite possibilities with an erasure. And I just want to show those possibilities beyond the words, like the possibility for justice. And I don't even know what that looks like. I don't even know what that looks like.
Nicole Seeley's book, The Ferguson Report, An Erasure, was published this summer. You can find some of the poems at newyorker.com. Seeley spoke with Kevin Young, the poetry editor of The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. I want to thank you for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Music in this hour was composed and performed by Gray Reverend.